Hello, and welcome to Torah in Motion's MP3 audio library. We hope you enjoy this recording of a live Torah in Motion presentation. For more information, please visit www.torahinmotion.org. Thank you.
Good morning, everybody. On behalf of Torah in Motion, Elliot Malamud, Ilana, my wife, and myself, Jay Kelman, we want to welcome you all to our fourth annual conference on Renewing Our Spirit. We hope you're having a meaningful day. For those who were here last night, know what a wonderful and a riveting program we had, and we hope that this will be a growth experience, and it'll whet our appetite for more and for extra exploration. I want to thank the people of Sher Shemayim for hosting the event. Rabbi Shulman was going to say a few words of welcome. Unfortunately, Rabbinic Hazard, he has a funeral he had to run off to. We should have only happy occasions. We are now standing in the weeks between Noach and Lech Lecha, between the B'nai Noach, the universal man, and Avram Avinu, and the founding of the Jewish people. Noach was an Ish Tzaddik, was a righteous, pure person. But ultimately, Noach had very little influence on the world around him. He was unable to save his generation of the flood. And ultimately, he was not chosen to be the leader of our nation. Noach is resting, is Lanuach. Noach rested. He took life in stride. God said, there's going to be a flood. Okay, there'll be a flood. I'll build an ark. I'll save myself. After the flood, he stayed in the ark. God had to actually tell him, leave the ark. It's an amazing thing. A year, he's cooped up in this little boat. You think he'd run out when he can. He had enough. He'll retire. He drank a little bit. Noach didn't have what it took to move forward. And that's, of course, why he cannot be the leader of the Jewish people. Avram Avinu was Lech Lecha. Avram Avinu was on the move. Halacha, the system of Jewish life, means that we're constantly on the move. Avram leaves his country, his parents, and he wanders the land of Israel. Halach v'naso ha-negba, v'yavar alim Avram ba'aretz. He passes throughout the whole land. He's an explorer. He's a revolutionary. He's a Jew. He's our leader. That's the path of the Jewish people, halacha, lech lecha, to always be on the move, to be in motion, to always look and face the challenges in the best way that we can, with the approach of our 3,035-year-old, our teaching, our Torah, our traditions. It is a pleasure for us at Torah in Motion, and really an honor for our community, to have gathered in one weekend such a wonderful group of speakers, of leaders, of teachers, and role models for us as Jews living in the complex world in which we do. They are passionate, thoughtful, inspiring, engaging, and energetic, living Torah and teaching Torah in the complex world in which we all encounter. It's a beautiful world out there, but it's also a dangerous world. We can follow the path of Noach and build arks, and for some that's the only approach that will actually work. Some people can't handle them. That's also an approach of righteousness. Noach was a righteous person. But for other people who that approach won't work, it can't work, they have to engage with the world around them. They have to be constantly, they're looking, they're searching and struggling how to integrate the modern world into our Jewish life. Our keynote speaker this morning is one of the leading, most eloquent spokespeople for Orthodoxy, for an engaged modern Orthodoxy, a life of passion and meaning, a true life of Torah. And it's an honor to have him with us and to introduce our guest speaker, Rabbi Berman. I'm going to call on Larry Krauss, who on behalf of all of us, I want to thank him. This is our fourth conference and the fourth year that he is sponsoring it in honor of the Yortzeit of his father, who passed away at a young age, went through the horrors of the Holocaust, had to start a second family, a second life, Lech Lecha. He moved on after the tragedy of a destroyed world, and it's a pleasure for me to call on Larry and to thank him on behalf of all of us for his support and encouragement. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Jay. Again, welcome to the fourth annual Renewing Our Spirit Conference. For each of the past 4 years, I've been impressed and enriched by the quality of this event, the speakers, and the content of their discussions. The audience has consistently grown, and that tells me two things. One, that you have shared the same experience as I have, and secondly, that there is a need and desire within our community to engage and study with leading educators and thinkers from throughout the modern Orthodox Jewish world. Again this year, Torah in Motion, through its very able organizers, Jay and Alana Kelman and Elliot Malamud, have engaged us in a process of education and enlightenment, of inquiry and discovery. And for this, they should be complimented and supported. The Krauss family, in remembrance and honor of my dear father, Nota Krauss, whose Yahrzeit will be this Wednesday, have chosen to support their efforts on an annual basis since Torah in Motion's founding. But as the organization grows and demands on the organization grow, and as programming opportunities develop, Torah in Motion needs additional tangible financial support, and I would ask those that are able to seriously consider such financial assistance. I've been asked to introduce the keynote speaker, Rabbi Saul Berman. Rabbi Berman is a prime example of the kind of scholar and teacher that we all need to study with. Rabbi Berman has a complement of degrees, including ordination from Yeshiva University, a degree in law from New York University, and a master's in political science from the University of California, Berkeley. He has as well studied at Hebrew University and Tel Aviv University. Rabbi Berman has, among other rabbinic roles, been the rabbi of Congregation Beth Israel in Berkeley and the senior rabbi of Lincoln Square Synagogue in Manhattan. In 1971, Rabbi Berman was appointed chairman of the Department of Judaic Studies of Stern College for Women at Yeshiva University and has taught there for over 30 years. He as well teaches at Columbia University School of Law. Rabbi Berman has a lot to teach us. As a rabbi at Beth Israel in Berkeley in 1965, he participated in the demonstrations along with Martin Luther King on behalf of the Black Civil Rights Movement in Selma, Alabama, being jailed not once but twice for his activities. He also was active in the Free Soviet Jewry movement. As Martin Luther King said, "The ultimate measure of a man is not where he stands in moments of comfort and convenience, but where he stands at times of challenge and controversy." Today, Rabbi Berman serves as a director of EDA, an organization devoted to the invigoration of modern Orthodox ideology and religious life. Rabbi Berman believes that this revitalization depends very much on our understanding of the moral and ethical purpose and message of each and every mitzvah and halakha. He believes, as is evidenced by his own activist record, that the Torah and our practice of it is very tangibly meant to be a light onto the nations, and only when we are able to appreciate the principles and objectives behind each mitzvah can we step beyond only its practice and engage in having a positive impact on the social and political world in which we live and are part of and feel integrated with that world. I recommend that when you have an opportunity, you read the comprehensive and broad-reaching vision statement of EDA on its website. On a personal note, Rabbi Berman's youngest daughter became engaged last night. So please join me in wishing Rabbi Berman a mazal tov and welcoming him as our keynote speaker.
I don't need this, right? First of all, I would like to thank Rabbi Jay Kelman and Dr. Elliot Malamet and Lana Kelman for extending the invitation to me to be here with you today. It's really both my pleasure and my honor to be here, particularly in the company of the extraordinary group of other teachers who are here today, some of whose classes I had the opportunity, together with many of you, to hear this morning, and others of whose classes I look forward to hearing this afternoon. My topic this morning is quite broad, and I'm reminded, I guess, of my favorite story. It's about a rabbi who's on an airplane and engaged in conversation with the man sitting next to him, and the man says to him, "What do you do?" And says, "I'm a rabbi." And the man sort of turns away for a moment and then turns back and says, "Gee, you know, I really don't know very much at all about religion, but I know that all of religion can be summarized in that famous phrase, love thy neighbor as thyself." Well, the rabbi was somewhat upset at the level of generalization in that, but continues the conversation and asks his neighbor what he does, and the man says, "Well, I'm an astrophysicist." The rabbi turns away for a moment and turns back to him and says, "Gee, I really know nothing at all about astrophysics, but I know that that entire discipline can be summarized in that famous phrase, twinkle, twinkle, little star." So I would like to avoid the sort of the degree of generalization involved in that. On the other hand, I would like to moderate somewhat the degree of detail that we need to do, and I hope I'll be able to strike a reasonable balance in our discussion today. What I want to do with you is to look at the future, orthodoxy of the 21st century. But in order to be able to look at orthodoxy of the 21st century, I need, for a while at least, just to turn back to look at where we have come. Because we stand here today in the year 2005, just 60 years from the ashes of Auschwitz. As we gather here today, we're just 60 years after the most devastating, darkest period in the history of the Jewish people. And yet, when I look at what we, the Jewish people, have achieved in these intervening 60 years, it appears to me to be absolutely astonishing. Because out of those ashes, look at what we have done as a people. We built a free and democratic nation in a region which has only known totalitarian regimes and which to this day has no other like it. We gathered in millions of displaced persons from Arab nations, from Ethiopia, from the Soviet Union, and provided them with the opportunity to build new lives in the midst of an Arab world which has kept a million of their own brothers as refugees in abysmal poverty for political reasons. We renewed the world of Torah to a point far beyond what had existed in Europe before the war. We've published more books of Torah, Chidushim, Tshuvot, Parshanut, that had been published in all prior generations together. We created a field of academic Jewish studies which, in its intellectual integrity and literary productivity, matches the best of academic fields. We created a network of social service organizations in Israel and throughout the world to serve every human social, psychological, and emotional need imaginable. And that would have been enough for any people to be proud of, very proud. But that's not nearly all that we achieved over this span of time. We created Jewish hospitals, outstanding in their quality of medical and humane care. We created institutions of higher learning which are the envy of the intellectual world. We provided opportunities for Holocaust survivors to be healed in body and soul, as we made provision for their children to deal with the continued trauma of their parents' experiences. We built cities, whole cities, with major cultural institutions and nurtured art and music and theater of world-class quality. We built museums to share with our people and with the whole world the grandeur of the Jewish experience, as well as the threat of genocide. And that would have been enough for any people to be proud of. And we've done even more than that. We developed an agricultural industry able to support our own and to share with the world. Coming from helplessness, from utter helplessness, we created one of the most powerful military forces in the world and invested it with a distinctive moral character. We created opportunities for women to study and teach Torah at levels beyond any that ever existed in our history as a people. We stationed outposts for the preservation of Jewish identity in the furthest points in the world where Jews might be found. We created synagogue movements and Jewish community centers to serve as vibrant focal points for Jewish life, for Jews of any ideological or theological persuasion. We contributed disproportionately to the wisdom of the world, evidenced by the high number of Jewish academics and Nobel Prize winners. We created networks of day schools and yeshivot to provide both Torah and general knowledge as the universal entitlement of every Jewish child. We have reason to be proud. We have reason to be proud as a people of what we achieved in the span of 60 years coming from a state of utter despair, utter dispersion and destruction. But two facts about that list beg our attention. Firstly, we did not all do every one of those great achievements. Right? Each of our communities, organizations, institutions, or friends did some small part. None of us, no segment of our community could possibly have achieved all of that. Chabad could not have produced Nobel Prize winners, as Weizmann Institute could not have established the Chabad House in Tanzania. Rabbi Steinsaltz could not have created Hadassah Hospital, as Hadassah Hospital could not have composed the commentary to open both Bavli and Yerushalmi to modern Hebrew speakers. The Israel Museum could not have trained 1,000 modern Orthodox rabbis to lead Jewish communities in America and throughout the world, or Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik Zatzal could not have cultivated a generation of world-class Jewish artists. Not only did we not do every one of those achievements together, in fact, we fought each other over many of them, over the ones that we did not support. Agudas Israel actively opposed the establishment of a secular state in the land of Israel. Right? You remember our Pirchei cards? Right? I was a card-carrying Pirchei member all the way through till college age, and the back of that card said, "We are opposed to the existence of a secular state in the land of Israel." Conservative and Reform Rabbinate in the United States fought against the establishment of day schools in the 1950s, 60s, even into the early 70s. Orthodoxy resisted the allocation of huge sums of money for Jewish hospitals and social service agencies. We didn't all do it, but cumulatively, we as a people achieved extraordinary things. Fact two. While some of these achievements were driven by positive vision, I would suggest to you that most of them were driven by fear. Fear of assimilation and intermarriage, fear of continued physical vulnerability of Jews, fear of exclusion by non-Jewish society, fear of the loss of intellectual excellence in Torah, fear of the alienation of Jewish women from Torah, fear of the disaffiliation of college students, fear that the world would forget the genocide of the Jews, fear of annihilation by a multitude of enemies. Those fears were, and many still are, real. And we responded to those fears with courage and tenacity and provided creative solutions. However, these productive forms of yirah, these productive forms of fear, have not been sufficient to enable us to solve yet another set of problems which confront us. We have not yet been able to solve the conversion crisis in Israel. We still somehow tolerate the enormous chilul Hashem of the continuation of the Agunah problem. We have not resolved problems of poverty in our people, in Israel, and all over the world. We have done very little to confront sexual harassment in our communities. There is an enormous disparity between Torah teachings and the reality in many areas of life. In the relationship to non-Orthodox Jews, in the relationship to Israeli Arabs, in the field of business ethics. The gap between religious and secular Jews in Israel, between Orthodox and non-Orthodox Jews in Gola, seems to become more intense over time rather than less intense. And fear will not help us address these problems. Fear will not move us in creative directions in the 21st century. We need to be motivated by something else. There are enormous fissures, human fissures within Jewish society. We are fragmented in so many different ways. And tolerance will not be sufficient to move us in new directions in the new century. Minimally valuing the other is the essential precondition for mutual caring and for the shared vision that is necessary into the future. So Rav Kook, Rav Kook in his commentary to the Siddur raises an important question which ought to be obvious to all of us davening the weekday Amidah 3 times a day. Rav Kook notes that there is a clear internal structure to the section of Bakashot in the Amidah. Correct? There are how many Bakashot in the middle of the Amidah? 13, right? 12 and the summation. What's the organization of those? How are they organized? Well, 3 times a day we say it, so we've got to know what it is that we're saying, right? Obviously, we know what we're saying. So they're organized by division of personal and communal. The first 6 are personal, and the next 6 are communal. But each of those sets of 6 also have an order to them. How are they organized? They're not just randomly thrown together. Very little in our liturgy is random. We recite things randomly, unfortunately, because of our lack of attentiveness to what we're doing, but the texts are not random. So what's the inner organization of the 6 petitions in which we talk to God about our personal needs, and the 6 petitions when we talk to God about our national needs, our communal and national needs? What's the inner organization of those? So in the area of personal needs, they're divided 3 and 3. The first 3 have to do with individual inner needs. Right? Inner needs. We need wisdom. We know that we need wisdom and that we need God's aid in achieving that wisdom. So we need wisdom. And we also need to be able to do tshuva, right? Inwardly, we need to be able to reconnect to God, and we need to be able to receive God's forgiveness. Those are elements of inner experience without which we can't progress in life, in our personal lives. And then after those three, come three others, which have to do not with our inner lives, but with our external lives. They have to do with the factors in the external world that constrain us, and our petition to God to help us deal with those factors. They have to do with our health, and they have to do with our material well-being, our wealth. Right? So that's what we do. We talk to God. Right? We talk to God three times a day about the things that are uppermost in our minds and our lives. Obviously, I mean, we're not going to waste God's time over Narishkeit, right? Unless that's why we daven so quickly, because we think that we're... Right? But if we take our tefillah seriously, then we know we're not going to talk to God about nonsense. We're going to talk to God about things that really impact on us, that are essential to our lives. And so we talk to God about our inner lives, and then we turn to God and we talk to Him about our outer lives. We talk to God about our spiritual identity, and then we talk to God about our outer material identity. And we ask His aid in all of that. And then we move on out of our personal existence. We move on to the national existence. And the national existence, there are also six brachot, and they also divide three and three. The first three having to do with national existence have to do with what? First, the ingathering of the exiles. Because obviously, right, I mean, you can't have a nation unless you ingather exiles, right? And then, immediately thereafter, the creation of a just society. Because it's obvious that that is the first fundamental task of any government, to create a just society. And then protection. Right? And then protection. So those have to do with the material character of the nation. And then, another three. What do the next three have to do with? Al HaTzadikim ve'al HaChasidim. Do with having spiritual leadership. And then having Yerushalayim as a center point, as the focal point of the divine presence in the life of the nation. And then redemption, right? Through the presence of governance in consonance purely with God's will. That is, the second set has to do with what? With our spiritual existence as a people. Asks Rav Kook a very simple and obvious question. Why is it that in regard to personal needs, in regard to personal needs, the spiritual precedes the material, whereas in regard to national needs, the material well-being of the nation precedes the spiritual. Right? Once you ask the question, the answer is obvious, is it not? It's just that you have to see the question. And sometimes the greatest brilliance is in the question, because the answer is obvious once you see it. Says Rav Kook, the answer is obvious, says Rav Kook. Because when it comes to the individual, if the individual does not form an inner spiritual powerful identity, then all of the external elements of material being have no meaning. But when it comes to the nation needs to have a sound material base. And upon that sound material base, it can build its spiritual reach. And therefore, said Rav Kook, all of those people who expend their energies and efforts and give their lives for the building of the material well-being of the nation Israel, they are engaged in laying the foundation for our spiritual existence. And their contribution needs to be recognized. Their contribution needs to be valued and appreciated. Equally with those who build upon it the spiritual development that can then come. Because without them, that spiritual development could not happen. It's in the perspective of Rav Kook. Not only those who learn Torah and teach Torah and create ideal communities separated from secular populace, in whom spiritual grandeur resides. It resides in those who ingather It resides in those who make justice in the society. It resides in those who defend the nation. That is what Rav Kook is teaching us, is something very simple. And that is, it's not enough just to tolerate the other. We have to learn to value the other, because without the other, we could not be who we could ultimately be. Right? If you think of all of those contributions jointly intersecting with each other and building upon each other, and each one of them ultimately necessitating all of the others in order to be built. That's how we need to be able to relate to others, says Rav Kook. Rav Soloveitchik makes a similar point in a different way. I'll talk about this at greater length this afternoon in regard to the question of women in the mitzvah of Talmud Torah. Rav Soloveitchik was not the first person who supported the importance of women studying Torah. God supported the importance of women studying Torah. But even after God, there were some others, few and far between, but others nevertheless. Chavetz Chaim, for example, clearly supported Sarah Schneer in her attempt to create the Beit Yaakov network of schools, and his support was vitally important. But it's fascinating. The Chavetz Chaim's support was premised on the proposition that things are rough and times are bad. And if we don't change the way we do things now, then we're likely to lose Jewish women altogether. So said the Chavetz Chaim, you know what? I mean, the advice of Rebbe Eliezer, about not teaching Torah to women, that's basically good advice. But Nebuch, we live in such corrupt times that we can't follow good advice, Nebuch. So we have to override that advice and go in a path that's not really desirable, but never harachmanus of that, we have to do what we have to do. It's eitz lasos l'Hashem, eitz feiru toratecha. We have to, overcome the barrier within Torah to protect Torah itself. So fundamentally within the approach of the Chavetz Chaim, the study of Torah by women is sort of, it's a concession to an evil reality. It took the creative minds of Rav Soloveitchik, Zatzal, of Lubavitcher Rebbe Zatzal, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein Shlita, to see that there's a whole other way of understanding the nature of women's relationship to the study of Torah. And they, in fact, forged a positive, not a negative path. Rav Soloveitchik taking the lead and arguing that it may be true, he said, that women are not obligated fully in the mitzvah of Talmud Torah. But you know what, he said? They are fully obligated in the mitzvah of Avat Hashem, in the mitzvah of loving God. And how do you achieve love of God? Through the study of Torah. The study of Torah. And so therefore, it may be the case that women are not obligated in the mitzvah of Talmud Torah, but being obligated in the mitzvah of Avat Hashem, they have to engage in study Torah. Because the study of Torah is what will enrich their Avas Hashem. And an interesting flip, because after all, he's the Litvak and Lubavitcher Rebbe is the Chassid. Lubavitcher Rebbe made the same argument, not out of the mitzvah of Avas Hashem, but out of the mitzvah of Yiras Hashem. Out of the mitzvah of fear and awe of God. Saying, okay, women are not obligated to, in the mitzvah of Talmud Torah, but they're obligated in Yiras Hashem. How do you expect them to be your Ot Hashem if they don't study Torah? They have to study Torah. Baron Lichtenstein made a parallel argument. I'll talk about that later on. The point is that what these geniuses of Torah saw was that if we want to transform the reality, we have to approach the reality out of affirmative valuing, not out of negation, not apologetically, but out of affirmative valuing. And it's in the affirmative valuing of women's study of Torah that women can become the full partners of men in the world of Torah and in the life of Torah and the life of the Jewish people. So we need a new approach for this next century in healing the divisions that exist amongst us. And a piece of that new approach I suggest to you is leaders who appreciate the diversity of contributions able to be made by the whole of the Jewish people to our own well-being, to the well-being of others in the world, and who value, cherish, and love those contributions. The approach needs now to pass from the approach of fear to the approach of love. To heal the relationship between Jews, we need to love and value other Jews. Second, I believe that our love of Torah must begin to be manifest in a different way. And this next argument is complex, and it will take me a little while to get there. I hope you'll follow along. The core of the argument that I would like to make builds out of the position of the Rambam in the Moreh Nevuchim, the Rambam in the Guide to the Perplexed, Book 3, beginning with Chapter 37. The Rambam there takes issue with some other Jewish philosophers, including Sadia Gaon, who had maintained that while some of the mitzvot of the Torah have rational basis, there are other mitzvot of the Torah, said Sadia, which are fundamentally irrational. That is, that while some mitzvot of the Torah derive from Chochmat Hashem, from God's wisdom about the nature of the human being, there are other mitzvot of the Torah, said Sadia, which derive from pure Ratzon Hashem, just the will of God, in which the human response that is called for is simply obedience to God's will. It is that which Sadia understands to be the chukim of the Torah. The chukim of the Torah, he says, that's what they are. Rambam takes issue with that approach. Rambam maintains that every one of the 613 mitzvot of the Torah is an expression of Chochmat Hashem, is an expression of the wisdom of God for the human benefit. Indeed, says Rambam, every law of the Torah has purpose. And he then goes further and says, I can even tell you, in broad strokes initially and then in finer strokes, what those purposes are. They are three in number, he says. First, it is the purpose of many laws of the Torah to teach us truths about the reality, because it is destructive to the human being to walk in the darkness of falsehood. Human beings have to know what's true in the world. And if you believe something that's false, it corrodes your soul. And therefore, says Rambam, the Torah will often teach us what is true so that we should be sure to know that. So if the Torah teaches us that there is only a single God and that that God is one, it's because that is the reality. Because that is the reality. That is truth. If the Torah teaches us that necromancy is forbidden, that attempts to communicate with the dead are forbidden, it's because, says Rambam, it is false. And anyone who tries to persuade you that he can communicate with the dead is in reality only communicating with your pocketbook. No, only Nevi'im can have a Nevu'ah, says Rambam, in which God may send them a message in the form of communication with the dead. But no human being can communicate with the dead. Says Rambam, this sits astride a whole host of different mitzvot of the Torah, where the Torah teaches us what is true and helps us to avert that which is false.